immediately he forced the disciples to get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Well, it's been quite a long time since I've been here. In fact, a lot has changed in my life. Many of you probably don't even know who I am or know me very well at all. I see some familiar faces. I had no kids last time I was here. My wife and I came. I'm newly married about 12 or so years ago. It was probably the last time we were here. Now I have four children. The Bowman girls were little last time I was here, about the age of my children. Now, just things change so much. Brother Plunk looks about the same, I think, but but I do appreciate so much this congregation. Those of you who weren't here way back then, you may not know how well and how good they treated young guys like me back then. I came sometimes to fill in for Russ then, and I was young, and you paid me much more than I deserved when I came for the work I did. And I just really appreciate how much you love preachers and how much you love the Word of God and you love Jesus Christ. And so that means a lot to me. I've been excited for a long time to be here. Russ talked to Jeff Wilson, my coworker, and about getting both of us out here at some point, wanting to make that happen. And Jeff came and talked to me about it, and immediately I was excited. I just wish my family could have come. They just couldn't. And we have a wedding tomorrow, and there's some things surrounding that my son had to be in and he just couldn't be here. But I would have loved for you to have met all of them and to be with them. That's enough for introductions. Russ can tell you, I told some young guys a while back not to do all this introduction stuff. Russ is a great sharpening tool for me. He will call me out on things when I say things, and other people don't do that. And people say, "I can't believe Russ said that to you." And I said, "I need him to say that to me." And you're probably not surprised by that, but I do appreciate Russ doing that for me. You know, it's so easy as a preacher to get up and to preach and to teach and have everybody congratulate you and tell you how well you do and all those sorts of things. And we have to be really careful about that. And we need people who would challenge us and say, "I'm not sure about that. Let's think about that some more." And Russ does that for me, and I really appreciate that about him. And I'm so glad he's been here for so long for you, and I know he loves you from the things he tells me about you. And so it's just good to be here this morning with you. I love this story. And in recent years, I've thought a lot differently about this story of Peter walking on the water. I think when I was younger, I thought this was a very negative story about Peter. And maybe you've thought this is a negative story about Peter. Maybe you're ahead of the game, ahead of me, and you realize that's really not actually the case. And I want to talk about that some this morning. Through life experience and through a lot of songs that have come out in recent years that have made me think about this kind of this story here, it's just changed the way I've seen it. And learning to read through the Gospels in a more narrative fashion has helped me to see this story in a little bit different light than I did in the past. And so hopefully, if you haven't done that yet, I can guide you through that a little bit this morning. Maybe you're ahead of me on that, and you just will enjoy this story in a way you've already thought of it. But I want us to see this in a way that actually I believe is helpful for us in our faith, because we're a lot like Peter, and we're a lot like these disciples. I love the words of a man named Matthew Skinner. Amazingly, Huffington Post actually puts out some good stuff sometimes, and he wrote in the religious section of this, he made this statement. He said, "When Peter steps out of his boat, he enters a tumult. His motive isn't to escape from threat. He goes into a situation where the threats will now look different, into a place where Jesus is defying and reordering the assumed boundaries. There's a lot of negativity, even in the scholarly world, about Peter and this stepping out of the boat and walking on the water as if he's trying to be like Jesus or some sort of thing like that. He wants to be divine, which I think is a gross misinterpretation of the passage. I think what it really is, and what Skinner ultimately talks about in the article, is he sees Jesus and he wants to go to Jesus. He wants to be where Jesus is. In a sense, although it just be an undertone in what we talk about this morning, I want that to kind of resonate with us and be that the feeling that we have about our faith, that we see Jesus and we just want to be with Jesus. We're drawn to him. We want to be where he is. And I think that's what's happening with Peter. In this walking on the water text, it really is quite different than the earlier one that I had read from Matthew chapter 8 in the scripture reading earlier, where this is a story that is about faithlessness. They're out on the water and they just don't trust. Jesus is there sleeping, a lot like Jonah does when he's out on the boat with these other men. He's just there. He doesn't care. He's not worried. He's running away from God in a kind of ironic twist. Now Jesus is the opposite. He is God and he is comfortable here asleep in Matthew 8. And they come to him and they say, "Don't you see what's happening?" And he says, "Oh, you of little faith." And of course, this is meant to connect to the story we just read. But I think the statement itself has a little bit different air to it. And we're familiar with this with text, because most of us text message now, or we send messages on the computer, and we understand that text doesn't always tell the whole story. Sometimes we have to know the personality. Sometimes we have to imagine the situation. And I do believe that when Jesus makes this statement here in chapter 14, it's somewhat different than what he says in chapter 8. I don't know if there's a sly smile on his face or what the physical appearance of this would be, but it seems from a narrative standpoint that he is taking a little bit different demeanor with the disciples. And I want to illustrate why I think that's the point. But where we need to begin with this story in Matthew 14 is the idea of the concept of Jesus' power and authority. And I want this to morph into what I think the isolated story is within chapter 14 and this one story. But in the context of this whole book, actually, but especially this section, what we see in this story is it's a story about the authority of Jesus, about the power of Jesus. And of course, this is no surprise. It's no surprise to the disciples, in reality. They are amazed by him in chapter 8. But if you'll just kind of thumb through the text here in the preceding pages, you'll see all the ways in which Jesus is demonstrating his power and his authority. We have these Sabbath confrontations in chapter 12, where he is shaming the rulers, the Pharisees and the scribes. They're challenging him, and he's challenging them. And in this culture especially, this is a matter of honor and shame. And he shames them before everyone. And he's a bit angry with them because the way they see the Sabbath. And he says, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." There's a statement being made here, this power and this authority that Jesus has as he's healing people and doing things on the Sabbath they don't approve of. And then there's this connection to Isaiah 42, a little bit later in Matthew chapter 12, this servant text, which is really a royal text, and we don't have time to get into that this morning. But there is a connection that he directly makes in chapter 12 of Matthew to Isaiah 42. And then he's casting out demons. And then he's claimed in the narration here that he is greater than Jonah and greater than Solomon. All of these texts illustrating the power and the authority of Jesus. And maybe you haven't seen the parables in this way in Matthew 13, but they're all parables of the kingdom. And when you're talking about kingdom and king, it's a statement of authority and power. And so these parables of the kingdom in chapter 3, they're also stating the power and the authority of Jesus. But as we get nearer to the story of Jesus walking in the water, and ultimately Peter walking on the water, it becomes even more clear. Now we have this confrontation with Herod. He's worried that John the Baptist is raised from the dead after he beheaded him, because he sees the power of what Jesus is doing. And the story directly preceding this story, Jesus feeds 5,000 people in the wilderness for a few loaves of bread. Now, there's all kinds of interesting connections to the Old Testament that are made. That I love these sorts of things, and I'll just highlight a couple of them. But in Psalm 22, verse 26, It talks about the afflicted, those who are hungry, those who are poor. They ate and are satisfied. The very next psalm, Mark, I think, refers to this even more in Mark chapter 6. It talks about them sitting on the green pastures, right? And so I think specifically in Matthew and in Mark both, there are indications toward this psalm. It says they all ate and were satisfied. They took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces of leftovers. So this kind of signaling or echoing of Psalm 22. And he has them sit down on the grass. And Mark, it says, he sit down on the green grass. Likely another connection to Psalm 23, the very next verse. And what we find here in this story, in the next very next story, is actually a connection to Psalm 107. And Psalm 107, I'll let you read that on your own time later, it talks about those crying out to him. And he calms the sea, he calms the storm, and he delivers them from their distresses. And it says, immediately brings them to their safe haven, which in John 6's parallel account, that's exactly what happens in this very story. He gets on the boat and it says, immediately they were at shore. Direct connection to Psalm 107, around verses 29 and 30, if you're looking it up. It's interesting that Jesus, not only is he exhibiting and displaying his power, but he's also doing it in a scriptural way. In a way, who people who know the Psalms, people who know Isaiah, people who know these Old Testament texts, they look at what Jesus is doing and they say, this man is powerful. He's powerful in a biblical way. He's fulfilling all these ideas and concepts from various parts of the Old Testament. He's healing people, fulfilling Isaiah 35. And that's exactly what he tells John's disciples. Remember, John sends people to him and says, are you the Christ? And he lists all these things he's doing. He's giving sight to the blind and he's healing the lame. And all of this is pointing to Isaiah 35 as a reference to this is going to be this time in the last days when there's going to be this restoration of God's people and of his kingdom. And so all of this is about Jesus' power and his authority. He forces the disciples out into the water. The earlier story, they follow him. They don't even know what they're getting into at that point in Matthew 8. They're following him. They follow him onto the boat. Things get really bad. They don't have a lot of faith. Here he forces them onto the water. We need to understand this is Jesus forcing them. That's actually the terminology in verse 22. It says immediately. Your version probably says made. But the word behind that is much more strong than that. Is he's forced the disciples to get into the boat. He says, you go, get in the boat, and you go to the other side. And in the midst of this story, he is redefining the natural boundaries by walking on the water. He's doing things that only God can do. He's forced them out into this situation. And now they find themselves in the midst of this storm a second time. And it gives this opportunity, I believe, to see what mid-faith crisis looks like. The earlier story, as I indicated, is really just a case of faithlessness. They don't really trust. But what I want us to see here is they understand the power and the authority of Jesus to some extent at this point, probably not fully. But when he forces them into the boat, they go. When he says, you go to the other side, they go, and then they get out into the sea and they begin going to the other side. And what we learn in the story with Peter and the other disciples, really, is what faith looks like in the moments of fear and doubt. And these moments come to us in all kinds of different ways, and they often reveal God's grace and mercy in the most powerful ways. In these moments of fear, in these moments of doubt, when things don't seem good, that's sometimes when we most understand the nature of God and who he really is. In the times we think faith may waver is really when our faith grows stronger. And so what we see in the story of Peter as he's walking on the water is kind of a strange sort of scenario where I think he is seeking this concept of transcendency, getting beyond the natural borders of this life and of this world. Jesus calls us beyond the boundaries of what we have here. And the reality is when people look at God's people, they think, why would they do that? Why would they live that way? Why would they do these sorts of things? From a purely human standpoint, from someone living in purely human terms, they can't understand why we would do the things we do. We do all this because there's going to be some life after this. You'll live in poverty sometimes, maybe, or you'll sacrifice some great things you can have here because you're going to come alive again. That doesn't seem to make sense. Now, I understand it makes sense to us because we've thought about it so much. And we've been reading this book so much, many of us, our entire lives. And so it makes a lot of sense to us. But to the purely human standpoint, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's going beyond what is understood. People don't raise from the dead. People don't come back to life. We struggle with the same types of things that people then struggle with in this sort of way. People don't walk on water. That doesn't happen. That's not the way things work in this world. And I would suggest to you this one truth is what provides comfort to all who truly believe. This reality that Jesus offers the transcendent. He offers what is beyond what we have here. There's something more than what we have in this life. That is actually what gives us comfort. The true believer, that's what gives us comfort in moments of doubt and fear. When they arise, when we don't understand the world that we're living in, when difficulties happen, when waves are crashing in that we don't understand how to get out of, this is what brings us comfort. And I would say on the other side of this, I can't understand the purely humanistic standpoint. I just can't fathom that. I can't fathom having some disease come to my body or losing a child or whatever it may be and having no hope beyond that. Only having this world and the vanity that is within this world, only having that, I can't understand how you even handle that. And so this is where the disciples, they're growing. They have lots of weaknesses and they fail often in the Gospels, which is a bit of hope for us in reality. I think that's why the story is told the way it is. That as we're growing and we're building in our faith, we're a lot like the disciples are. But we need to see the story for where it begins, and that is the authority of Jesus. And the disciples recognize that. You know, Peter doesn't go on the water on his own whim. He doesn't see Jesus out there in the water and say, hey, that looks like fun. I'm just going to jump out here and run to him. That's not what Peter does. Did you catch that in the reading? He says, Lord, if it is you, or Master, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. He moves on the commandment of Jesus. Jesus says, come. And then he comes. He waits for the Lord to command him to come to him. When the whole story is over, when Jesus comes on the boat with them, it says they worshiped him saying, truly you are the Son of God. There's certainly a statement about authority, about the power of Jesus in this story. Even in his statement to them, his declaration, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid, is kind of that divine epitaph, I am, in Greek. It's the divine statement. He says, don't worry about it, I am God. And so there are certainly statements of authority and power that are going on here in this story. But now I want us to transition and get into what I think is going to be most helpful for us in pulling from the story in ways that I think will help us in a very big way. And that this story goes from a story about Jesus' authority to a story about man's struggle for faith and what that struggle looks like. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that sometimes we get the story in a way that's not exactly what's happening here. And maybe it is because of maybe some of the songs we've sang that are indirectly related, something like Love Lifted Me, which is a good song. And I think it is loosely based on this story. But it's interesting to me the way it begins, I was sinking deep in sin. And I would suggest to you that's not what's happening here in this story. Peter is not sinking deep in sin. He's sinking deep in obedience, is actually what he's doing. If we remember that the context of the story, that Jesus forced them into the boat and he told them, go to the other side, what do the disciples do? They get into the boat and they go to the other side. What's happening in the midst of this? There is a huge storm beating all around them. The term actually used in it means torment. The waves are tormenting the boat. This is not a light storm. And keep in mind, these men understand what it's like to be out at sea. A good percentage of them are fishermen. And so just a few waves and some wind isn't going to bother them. But they are frightened. And if you've ever seen, or especially if you've been to this area in the Sea of Galilee, you can understand how quickly all of this can happen and you can get yourself in big trouble fast. It's essentially a big bowl. Maybe some of you have been there. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. You drive in and you start driving down. It's like our interstate. You're kind of on an interstate. You drive down and all of a sudden you kind of see this bowl. It looks kind of like a breakfast bowl you would use. Very steep decline right to where the sea is. And what happens is the wind whips up over those mountains and it sweeps in quickly, and huge storms can come on the sea in just a moment almost. And we know from John 6 that they're 3-4 miles out at sea at this point. I mean, they're not near the shore. And likely they're in the midst of the sea. They're kind of going from the northeastern side of the Sea of Galilee down toward the west, which puts them right smack in the middle of this storm. And the wind is in their face. And I would suggest this, actually, the whole story hinges on the reality that they have pushed deeper into the storm simply because Jesus commanded them to. Kenny Chumley, some of you might know him, wrote a commentary on Matthew. And this is what he has to say about this story. It would have been easier to have turned around and run with the wind. But Jesus had said, "Go to the other side." And this they were determined to do. The notion that the presence of hazards or difficulties indicates one is outside the will of God is unwarranted here. The disciples were facing rough going precisely because they were obeying Christ. It was due to their obedience that they're out there in the middle of the sea in the first place. He told them to get in the boat and he said, "Go to the other side." And so they do that. And when they do that, when they obey Jesus, now they find themselves in the midst of the storm. They're tormented by the waves. And then Jesus appears. In Mark's account, we know he actually meant to pass them by. Don't know exactly what that looked like. I don't know if he was trying to keep at a distance and he was just going to go by them or how it all worked. But he meant to pass them by. But when they see him, they cry out. They're terrified. They think it's a ghost. They see themselves hanging on to life by a thread here. They're being beaten by the winds and the waves. And they did have a lot of superstitious thoughts in those days about God's controlling the underworld and the sea. And so maybe they think this is some demon. And we have to remember as well that demon possession is a very real thing in their world. The spirit realm is very present. It's very visible. And so we see Jesus casting out demons, and we see even the apostles casting out demons later. And so this is something that is a part of their world that we don't likely understand. And they see this, what they think may be a ghost out there, and they think the end is near. Until Jesus says, "It's I. Don't be afraid." And so when Peter sees that, he wants to go to Jesus. He's going deeper into the storm either way. If he's going to go to the other side, he's either going to be on the boat or he can be with Jesus. And where he wants to be is with Jesus. And so he says, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you." And he does. There's multiple levels of struggle in this story. The first is just the initial struggle. They're out there on the sea with the winds beating them all around. And the next, of course, is when Peter comes into the water at Jesus' command, and then he sees the waves, he sees the wind, and he begins to sink. And now the waves are crashing around him directly. But what we're finding in this is not that Peter is in the midst of sin, but really that he is in the midst of what I'm calling a mid-faith crisis. He is acting in faith. He's out there in the sea precisely because he is obedient to Jesus. He's doing the will of Jesus. He's out there trying to do what Jesus wants. And now in the midst of all of that, there is trouble and difficulty. Have you ever felt like that? That precisely because you're trying to do the right thing, because you're trying to follow Jesus, because you're trying to do his will, now you're having struggle and difficulty in your life. Maybe it's family that mocks you or just doesn't understand you or gives you a hard time about decisions you're making or decisions you're making for your children. Maybe it's friends that you've had in the past who don't understand why you're doing the things you're doing. Sometimes it's even those who claim to be religious, isn't it? They don't understand the decisions that we make. Life can just be difficult. And that's what we're seeing here with Peter. With the disciples, it's just hard. It's not because they've sinned. It's not because they've done something wrong. It's actually quite the opposite here. But in general, life is just hard sometimes. I was struck by a book I picked up in the library a few months ago by a woman named Lauren Winter. It's called Still. And she uses this phrase, which I'm borrowing from her, describing her life in the mid-faith crisis that she had. She had a lot of struggles. She had a broken marriage she was trying to deal with, one that she admitted was mostly her fault. And she's trying to come out of that as someone who's still a believer, someone who's still trying to live the way Jesus wants her to live. And I thought some of the things she said made a lot of sense to me and would make a lot of sense to other believers. This is the sort of thing she said. She said, "Once upon a time, I thought I had arrived. I would have said, blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. Things are good. I mean, Jesus is on my side. Everything is going my way. From here, I say with the poet, O Lord of mercy, though I'm not ready nor worthy, I climb towards you." She's in despair. She finally realized things don't always go well in life. But what are we going to do in those moments? How are we going to react when things aren't going our way? And maybe it is because of this that we struggle with things like prayer. I'll tell you, one of the things I hear so often, and I've felt it myself, and I'll just be upfront with you on a lot of this. I've felt many of these things myself, which is why I preach on it, because it's helpful to me. But I've also heard so often, I want to know things about prayer. How can prayer be more effective? Why isn't prayer happening in a more powerful way in my life? Why doesn't God answer me? All these things related to prayer. Another woman made this statement. Prayer was the last skill I learned. I practiced rigorously. Just as I was getting good, I lost it. As soon as it was gone, I understood it was not a skill at all. Her point is, we get so formal sometimes with the things that we do. And again, get the undertone, he saw Jesus and he just wanted to go to him. That's what faith is. Right? We don't always have all the answers. Things don't always make clear sense to us. It's not just about saying all the right phrases and saying them in the right way and constructing and outlining a perfect prayer and something that's going to say it the best way possible. Sometimes it's just seeing Jesus and wanting to go to Jesus. No matter how the mystery of life unfolds before us. I want you to think about Peter's faith in this moment. I mean, he understands the world on water. He is a fisherman. And he says, "If it's you, Lord, command me to come to you." I can't even imagine the amount of faith it took for Peter to get on the edge of that boat and start to drop into the water. It is a moment of exceptional faith. That while the storm is around him and winds are beating the boat, he was actually willing to step out of that boat. All measure of safety and security and protection that he could possibly have around him from a human standpoint, he was willing to step out beyond that. Because Jesus called him out and said, "Come." That's just unimaginable faith. This is not a negative thing for Peter. This is an insurmountable, positive thing for him. And this is where I want us to kind of feel, have this sympathy with Peter and the same sorts of things we feel in life, where we step out in faith and we do things simply because Scripture tells us to, even though the world would criticize us for doing it, how we raise our children and how we discipline them, the types of things we'll do in life and what we keep ourselves from in life. And the world will mock that and criticize it and say it doesn't work and all kinds of other things that to cast a negative light on the people of God and what they're trying to do because of what Scripture says. We step out in faith. In the midst of that, we fail. Just like Peter, because we're not perfect. And sometimes we do have fears, and sometimes we do have doubts. And in these moments, I think we feel sometimes like that man in Mark 9 who says, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." Have you ever had that kind of feeling when you just have seen something so amazing? I felt that. I don't know if I've expressed those exact words. But we just have doubts. And young people, if you have doubts, you shouldn't run from those and deny them. You should lean in on them. You should go toward them. You should investigate them. And those of us who are older, the same thing. When we have doubts, when we have fears, we need to approach those. We shouldn't run away from them. We shouldn't flee from them. That's the wrong response. But have you ever stood and just seen something that is so magnificent, it just affects you? I remember when I was younger, I used to ski every weekend when I lived in Vermont. And there was a mountain that I would ski on, and it was just amazing. But I went up, it's just like going up a straight wall all the way to the top. We'd had a lot of snow, and there'd been a lot of ice, a lot of freezing. And going up that mountain, it looked like a snow globe. Someone turned over and just put back. It was just amazing and beautiful. And you can't even comprehend when you see something like that. You know, the vastness of the world and the greatness of what God has created. We just can't even comprehend how someone, how a being who could be that powerful, who could create, who would not only that, but think of us, as the Psalm says in Psalm 8. And at one moment, I believe. At the next moment, I'd say, help my unbelief. I can't even comprehend how amazing and how great you are. And I just do my very best. Kind of like the poet said, I'm climbing towards you. I'm not worthy of who you are. I believe, but help my unbelief. And so our fear can be attacked, our faith can be attacked by fears and doubts of all kinds of types and various forms that even torment us as we're striving in obedience. Sometimes it is because of our sin. Sometimes it is because of our faults, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's in the midst of our obedience, in the midst of our faith. Things just happen in life that create problems for us, that cause us to fear, that cause us to doubt. Maybe it is a wayward child causing family distress. And we all fail as parents, and we know that. But maybe it does not have anything to do with the way they're brought up or what they were taught. But they make a choice. In the midst of that, where we have waves beating against us, and we have stress, and we have difficulty, and now we have doubts, and we have fears. Or maybe it is a broken or struggling marriage. And maybe through no fault of your own. Maybe it was your spouse who betrayed you. Maybe it's the death of a parent, or a child, or a grandchild. The loss of health. Unexpected diagnosis. That changes, that shocks our world forever. And these are all kinds of different forms and maybe different levels even. Maybe it's just the loss of a job or a faltering career. I mean, that's not death, but that can be serious. That can create some doubts. How could God let this happen to me? We may be tempted to think or say. Or just the hatefulness of someone who's supposed to be your friend. Or maybe it's miscarriage. Or failed adoptions. Or inability to conceive. I imagine I've hit everybody in this room at some point during all those. And we know what fear is, and we know what doubts are. And we know the struggles that we have, even in the midst of our faith. And what I'm saying is that's what Peter's doing. He stepped out of the boat in great faith, and yet in the midst of that, he sees the wind, metaphorically. He's seeing the waves, is what he's seeing, crashing around him, and he looks away from Jesus, and he begins to sink. There's a song that I've listened to and sung to my little boy for quite a while now, parts of it at least, that you may have heard. It's a popular song nowadays, In the Eye of the Storm. I love the song. It's great. There's parts of it that are weaker than others if you're going to analyze the song. But, man, it's just a great song. And here's why. It talks about the eye of the storm and God remaining in control. And here, we all know this in the part of the country we live in. When you're in the eye of the storm, it's just a calm before the next storm that comes. Right? It's not the end. It's not that we're out of it and everything is clear now. No, we're still in the middle of it. But the statement is about the power and the authority and the control of God. In the eye of the storm, you remain in control. Your love surrounds me, he says in the eye of the storm. He understands where the comfort comes from, where the stability comes from. And Ryan Stevenson, who wrote the song, he was a paramedic for a long time and actually talks about how that affected even the words of this song. His wife miscarried twins. And he had friends that lost a daughter to a disease. And if you have ever heard the song or know the song, you know the third line, the third verse in the song really talks about some of that, losing a child to sickness and not knowing what to do. But he says, my only hope is to trust in you. That's Peter. Right? He's out in the water and he begins to sink and he just cries out. Right? He sees Jesus again and he wants Jesus. He cries out, "Lord, save me." And Jesus is there to reach out his hand. It's interesting to me, even the progression of Peter in the Gospels. In Luke 5, early in the story, when Jesus is calling his disciples, you'll remember this, Jesus goes out, they're fishing, and they're not catching anything, not a good day for fishermen. They're bringing the nets in, nothing's happening, and he says, "Throw your nets out into the deep." And Peter says, "Okay, you know, we're professionals, Jesus, and we haven't caught anything all day, but at your word, we'll do this." Right, and then he pulls the fish in, and he's amazed, and he says, "I'm not worthy of you." And there's a bit of faith there, and that's worth talking about. But it's interesting that we get to this story, and he says, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you into the deep." Now he's ready. There's a progress here. There's a growth of faith. And even though he begins to waver a little bit there in the middle, it's in the midst of this great faith. And that's what I want us to see in our own lives. We see ourselves, and if you're anything like me, you look and you think, "Man, I just struggle so much, and I have this lack of faith. I ought to trust more." But I think sometimes we need to realize the amount of trust and faith that we actually do have in the midst of all of that. And the direction that we're headed in our life, and the things that we have decided to do. And yes, we do waver, and sometimes we do fall. But that's the glorious part of the story. It's a story about the struggle of man's faith, but also in the end, it's a story about Jesus' abundant grace. He calls Peter out into the water, and he watches him fail. You know, God could say, "This is what I want you to do," and he could watch us fail, and he could say, "You know, that's it. I told you what to do, and you didn't do it. You wavered, you didn't believe, and so that's it, I'm done." But he watches Peter fail, and he still reaches out his hand and takes hold of him as he's sinking. And I would say this about that God's grace gives us the confidence to take steps of faith. Those steps of faith that are talked about in Romans 4 about Abraham walking in the steps of the faith. God calls him out and he goes out to a place he doesn't even know where he's going. And does he make some mistakes along the way? Yes, he does. But he believed God. And he went out. Not even knowing where this life was going or what the mystery would be and how it would be revealed to him. He followed the will of God, and that's what he asks us to do. Peter steps out in faith, and though he wavers in the middle, Jesus is there to reach out his hand and steady him and pick him up. And so the grace of God, it gives us this confidence to step out in faith, even when the outcome is uncertain. When the steps bring fear and doubt. And so I'd ask you, what steps of faith are you worried about? What things do you fear? I'll give you some examples on my end, because I think this helps to think through this. And maybe in ways we don't always think. Yeah, I have four children. And I have a big obligation in that home to raise those children in a godly way. And we have struggled to find consistency, you know, in how we, are we going to do a family devotion every night? Are we going to read the Bible together? And I'll be the first to admit that we just haven't done those sorts of things very well. We found some ways to do some of that, but that's a struggle. But you know what's really interesting about this, and men, maybe some of you can understand this, it's really hard as a man to say, "Okay, we're going to start doing it this way." Right, because you think your wife's going to say, "We haven't done that for 15 years. And now you want to do that?" And you ladies might think, that sounds weird. Why would you think that? I'm just telling you, this is a struggle sometimes. We have patterns and we have habits and we want to step out of that. We would like to do the right thing, but sometimes it feels like a struggle. We're worried about what someone's going to say, and maybe it's outside of that example. Maybe it's a situation with your extended family or whatever, where you want to make some kind of decision. You want to step out in faith, but you're afraid because of the criticism. Or because you think this isn't going to work anyway. I'm going to try this and it's going to be like other things we've tried. It's going to fail. But what I want us to see is from this Peter story, you'll learn that's okay. We need to step out in faith. We need to get out of the boat. We need to see Jesus. We need to go to him. We need to make decisions in our life that are showing that progress of faith. And as we go deeper into this storm, we want to go with Jesus along the way. I love how Matthew Skinner finishes his article. He says, the nature of faith, humble, active faith, to be willing to throw oneself into a disorderly world and expect to encounter Jesus there. Is the nature of faith, even little faith, to want to transcend the normal rules and see what possibilities might be brought into being? It is the nature of faith even to waver from time to time when it has stepped into stressful, unfamiliar terrain. Because as Peter discovered, Jesus is there where the boundaries are being redrawn, extending life-giving stability when the chaos gets the upper hand. It's a story about Jesus' abundant grace. His willingness to reach out to those who are people of faith, people who want to come to him, who want to live like him and to follow him in their life. He wants to reach out when they say, Lord, save me, and he wants to deliver us. Even in the midst of this crisis of faith that we may be having, as we face sickness, maybe even death, a struggling child, whatever the situation may be, whatever the doubts and fears may be, he wants us to continue on in faith, and he's there. He understands. We have a sympathetic high priest, the Hebrew writer tells us. He understands what it's like to be human because he came in the flesh. I hope this is helpful to you this morning. I think sometimes if you're like me, you get down on yourself and you feel like, am I good enough? And I want us to understand this story is not about Peter being good enough. It's the reality that he saw Jesus and he went to Jesus. And even in the midst of failure, Jesus was there to raise him up. And he wants to do that for us. And maybe you've been struggling with that even today. Maybe you're a mom and you just wonder, how am I going to raise these kids? Do I even know what I'm doing? Or maybe you're a father, I got a family to take care of. Am I doing this the right way? We all have those doubts. We all have those fears. It's time to step out in faith and trust what's said here and put our faith in Jesus Christ. Can we help you do that this morning? Why don't you come as we stand and we sing together?